Hi, this is Marketplace Money for the weekend of October 16th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We've heard a lot over the past year about how much money Americans lost in their 401k retirement plans and how, as the managers of their own accounts, maybe they should have paid a little more attention to the risk in their investments. Turns out the pros managing other people's retirements weren't any smarter about it. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today.
So we really have ourselves to blame for losses in our 401ks and IRAs. But when it comes to pensions, well, those are managed by supposed professionals. Yet a recent PricewaterhouseCoopers analysis found the average government pension fund will have less than half the money it needs for retirees by the year 2025. Turns out pension managers poured workers' cash into risky investments, much of it washed away in a sea of subprime slime. Now some of those same managers say the only way to meet their obligations is to jump back into the same waters. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
Government workers held their breath as they watched a drumbeat of bad news roll across their TV screens last year.
We haven't seen anything like this probably since the Great Depression, I think.
What started in America last year has now spread to every part
of
the world.
Stocks are set to kick off lower a whole lot.
Pay is down 6.5%.
Government workers watched as their pension funds lost about $1 trillion, according to the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Now some funds are turning back to risky investments with the potential for big payoffs. Investments like securities backed by mortgages that got us into trouble in the first place.
I think anyone would be crazy to even consider investing in mortgage-backed securities at this time in view of what happened, took place last year.
That's Ralph White. He's a retired Massachusetts parole officer. White worries about the health of the state pension fund. On the other side of the country, Kathy Hackett is also concerned. She's a budget analyst in the California Transportation Department. She's 60. Thinking about retirement. Hackett is so anxious about pensions, she's running for a seat on the board of CalPERS, California's $200 billion pension fund. Hackett is also a union shop steward. She hears this a lot from the rank and file, worried about their pension money.
Will it be there when I retire?
Hackett tells them CalPERS is making reasonable investments, but the union is keeping an eye on them. And CalPERS isn't shying away from risk. CalPERS spokeswoman Pat Mock says it's now looking for bargains in commercial real estate.
There are some now that you can buy at a fire sale. And if we think they have good underlying economics, then we might invest in them.
Mock says CalPERS is reviewing its investments in light of the $50 billion it lost in the last fiscal year. Government pension funds across the country lost money, and now many are underfunded.
There's a big time bomb out there.
Consultant Alan Biller is trying to defuse that bomb. He's advising pension fund boards not to make overly risky investments they think will pay off big as cities and counties slash contributions to the funds.
Puerto Rico was a classic case. I mean, Puerto Rico's pension plan was an outright disaster. New Jersey's plan has been woefully underfunded. There are lots of plans like that. We're talking hundreds of billions, I would say.
But Timothy Feierstein says stodgy stocks and bonds just don't cut it anymore. He's chief administrative officer for Montgomery County, Maryland. He says fund managers have to take some risk to generate enough pension money.
If you totally ignore an investment category, you might also miss an opportunity.
But Feierstein says investing isn't the only way funds can make up for their losses. Some states require workers to contribute to their retirement benefits. States can also encourage workers to delay retirement. Their last resort? You. Consultant Alan Biller.
Ultimately, the taxpayers will foot the bill. So in the sense that public plans generally taxing power, they have something to fall back on.
And a fallback option may well be needed. Some state constitutions guarantee retiree benefits. So whether the money is there or not, it'll have to be paid out. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
This week, a bunch of the country's biggest banks reported third-quarter earnings. JPMorgan Chase and Goldman Sachs turned profits. Citigroup and B of A reported losses. Meanwhile, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is closing down smaller banks just about every week. The FDIC is the government agency charged with making sure customers can get their money out of a failed bank. But daily reports on the FDIC's health have a lot of people wondering about their deposits. So we've brought in banking analyst Karen Petrue of Federal Financial. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Let's get some basics out of the way first. Really just give us a rundown of what the FDIC covers when a bank fails.
The FDIC covers insured deposits up to $250,000 per account. So sometimes if you have different types of accounts, you might get more coverage than that. But in general, it's $250,000 of an insured deposit.
Then why are we seeing all these headlines these days about the health of the FDIC itself? There seems to be a lot of concern that they are bailing out so many banks that they're going to run out of money.
It's going to replenish the fund before that through the banks. But if for some reason that didn't work, there's always Uncle Sam. The FDIC has a $500 billion line of credit with the U.S. Treasury. So insured deposits at FDIC insured institutions are very, very safe.
Has the FDIC ever not made good on its promise to any bank depositor?
It has always made good on its promises to insured depositors. It's important to remember that some accounts are uninsured, so you shouldn't expect the FDIC to honor uninsured claims, but it's always made good on all of its insured ones.
And what's the difference between the insured deposits and the uninsured deposits? Is that simply where you bank?
No, it's how much you hold. Any bank with an FDIC sticker on it, which is all regulated banks and savings associations, is protected by the FDIC. The difference is the amount you hold. Up to $250,000, you're fine. $250,000 and $1, that $1 becomes an uninsured deposit, and it is subject to risk.
And you can then spread out your deposits, can't you? You can put them with different institutions, and then you have up to $250,000 at each one of them?
Absolutely.
So what should consumers be watching for when it comes to these headlines that are very worrying when you read them that say, you know, that the FDIC is in trouble?
I don't think consumers need to worry. As long as their money is at a regulated bank or savings association, your money is safe up to the deposit insurance limits.
Karen Petrue is a banking analyst at Federal Financial Analytics. So nice to have you on the program. Thanks for your help.
Thank you very much.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The unemployment rate for adults over age 65 has doubled since the recession began. Elderly immigrants are especially vulnerable. They have a small safety net to start with. And on top of it all, legal immigrants don't get much in the way of government assistance. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler visited some immigrant communities here in Southern California and shares their stories with us.
These elderly Filipino Americans get together once a week to socialize. At a senior center in Los Angeles, they talk about having to make do with less. California's statewide budget cuts have reduced their supplemental income benefits, but at least they collect something. Jerry Geronimo is 69 years old, but he doesn't get Social Security.
No, not yet. I'm not yet a citizen. 3 more years.
He is a legal immigrant. Geronimo and his wife waited a long time for green cards.
23 long years. We waited for the petition.
In the Philippines, Geronimo says companies won't hire seniors.
You cannot work at the age of 60. You have to retire.
In the U.S., he qualifies to work, but struggles to find the opportunities.
I want to find a job.
He works part-time in a job training program. Because of the economy, his hours have been cut. Together with his wife's income, they bring in less than $1,000 a month. His sister-in-law was supposed to sponsor them and help them financially. But instead, Geronimo is paying all the bills.
The electricity, the gas, and the water bill. She has no money at all.
As a young man in Manila, he adopted the name Ray and worked as a DJ.
99.5 Audio DJ Ray Geronimo.
He applied for a job at a Filipino radio station in Los Angeles, but hasn't heard back yet. Other elderly immigrants come here to work in the home. They look after grandkids, saving the family money on childcare while the parents work at minimum wage jobs. Stephen Wallace is a UCLA professor of public health who studies trends in immigration. He says the recession has caused job losses for some two-income families, cutting their income in half. But at the same time, they still have that extra person to support.
As a result of having to stretch the dollars even further, the poverty rate among immigrant elders is higher than the poverty rate among elders as a whole.
Many elderly immigrants tend to feel responsible for the financial welfare of the extended family. Susan Dilks runs a social services agency in Los Angeles helping elderly Filipinos.
In our country, the elderly are the breadwinner. They support their children. And then when they come here and they're staying with their children, they really feel that they're a burden to them.
Only about 20% of U.S. immigrants arrive after the age of 50. Most transplants come as young adults. But UCLA professor Stephen Wallace says young immigrants who grow old here are often not much better off.
Most immigrants who come to the United States are in low-wage industries. So when they retire, they don't have pensions, they don't have savings.
Wallace says immigrants need to work in the U.S. on the books for 10 years before they can claim federal benefits.
So if you're cleaning houses and you worked for cash for 30 years and never reported that income to Social Security, you would retire with no pension and no eligibility for Social Security or SSI.
In addition to the financial hurdles, elderly immigrants also face cultural challenges. The recent Pacific Islander Festival in Huntington Beach was like a Polynesian battle of the bands, showcasing the cultures of Fiji, Samoa, Tahiti, and other islands. Old country traditions are a source of pride, but elderly immigrants steeped in those cultures can also feel cut off. Greta Briand with the Pacific Islander Health Partnership works with seniors from the Marshall Islands.
They cannot speak the language, so they need to have someone to go with them anywhere they want to go.
Some seniors reached the conclusion that the grass was greener in the old country. Faifua Vaifali says seniors miss the island life.
They want to go back home because back home, you know, a lot of things are free.
In the U.S., you need a job and money to survive. She says in Samoa, seniors can feed themselves with just a fishing pole. In Huntington Beach, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
You expect people in certain jobs to see signs of the recession, financial planners, economists, but dentists have a front row seat too.
On these films right here that we're looking at, you can see this area on the top of the tooth represents a fracture of the cusp of the tooth from clenching or grinding.
A mouthful of financial stress up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week, the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences was awarded to two Americans. Eleanor Ostrom and Oliver Williamson will split the $1.4 million prize. I would try to explain what they won for, really, but we just don't have time. Instead, economics editor Chris Farrell wants to hand out his own award, the Marketplace Money Prize in Personal Finance.
I nominate and choose John Jack Bogle. Bogle founded the mutual fund giant Vanguard in 1974. A year later, he made market history by creating the first Standard & Poor's 500 equity index fund for individual investors. The low-cost index fund movement he pioneered revolutionized investing for ordinary folks, and for the better. He's also written a number of books that wisely lay out the basics of investing and managing money. That's enough of a reason for recognizing Bogle, but at 80 years old, the financier with an ailing transplanted heart isn't resting on his laurels. Far from it. He's on a full-throated crusade to rescue America's busted retirement savings system. He says greedy financiers have taken the public to the cleaners. Rebellion against price-gouging financiers runs deep in his family. His great-grandfather, the life insurance executive Philander Bannister Armstrong, railed against widespread swindles in the insurance business in the early 20th century. He established a low-cost life insurance company. It must run in the Bogle genes. He wrote a scathing expose called A License to Steal, Life Insurance, the Swindle of Swindles. His great-grandson has updated the outrage more than a century later. The target is Wall Street and mutual funds and the high fees they charge to manage our money. Bogle thinks we're all getting a raw deal, and he wants to stop it. He's lobbying for an independent federal retirement board. Its mandate would be to simplify investment choices, slash fees, and protect savers from unnecessary risks. It's a quixotic venture, but I say, go, Jack. And if you succeed in this latest venture, how about being the first chairman? Oh, and one other thing. We don't have 10 million krona or $1.4 million to give with our prize like the Nobel Committee. Fact is, I just checked, and we don't have any swag to give. No Marketplace Money t-shirts, no Marketplace Money mugs. Just the prize and our thanks.
Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, who invites Mr. Bogle to join him for the award presentations in Minnesota. Hey, it's not Oslo, but the weather's the same. Struggling your way through a recession is just about as pleasant as a root canal. And apparently, just about as profitable for dentists. Kurt Nickisch of WBUR in Boston tells us the stresses of a bad economy are taking a toll on our teeth.
In the Boston suburb of Andover, Kathy Mizuki lives on Penny Lane.
Penny Lane is in my ears and in my eyes.
And just like in the Beatles song, all seems peaceful at Mizuki's house. Inside, her two teenagers are reading. Outside, beneath the blue suburban skies, the birds are singing. But behind this idyllic picture lurks a whole lot of stress. Those kids. Kathy Mizuki knows they're going to need college tuition in the next couple years.
And what savings we had or investments we've had have just bottomed out. Not only do you have your expected education costs, but how are you going to be able to save for retirement when the stock market is such a mess and your investments are such a mess? It's a little bit hopeless.
Mizuki's a substitute teacher and schools are cutting back. Her husband works in sales, not exactly the best thing to be in when consumer spending is down.
So he has the stress of being the solitary breadwinner at this time. Just so much stress. And that's where he takes it out, is on his teeth.
He grinds his teeth, and so does she. She always has, but this recession is making it worse.
The stitches are a lot easier coming out than going in. This just takes a few minutes and you'll be all set.
Mizuki recently visited her periodontist, David Samuels. Her teeth grinding had exposed part of the jawbone.
It's literally like taking a forceps over many years and extracting a tooth. That's how much pressure that some people can put on their teeth at night.
Samuels says patients who take out stress on their teeth while they sleep is nothing new, but the recession is, and he can see its effects in some patients' x-rays.
On these films right here that we're looking at, you can see this area on the top of the tooth represents a fracture of the cusp of the tooth from clenching and grinding. So even on the x-rays, we can see evidence, if you will, of increased stress in someone's life, you know, and we do see more of that now than we used to.
About twice as much. Samuels is also the head of the Massachusetts Dental Association. Its 5,000 members report that business from stress-related tooth injuries has doubled. Fixing a cracked tooth can cost thousands of dollars, so Samuels recommends his teeth-grinding patients get a protective bite guard.
So this is a night guard that's about to be delivered. We use a very sort of specialized lab in New Jersey for these.
Custom-fit bite guards can cost as much as $800, and even if you have dental insurance, they're usually not covered. The problem, Samuels says, is that if people need a bite guard because they're stressed out over money, they probably can't afford one.
No, I am not grinding my teeth.
That's Glenn Bancroft. He's not grinding his teeth because business is good. He runs a Massachusetts company that sells basic bite guards online for $10 a piece.
And a lot of people just don't trust their dentist. They really don't.
Bancroft's statistics from Google tell him that 10 million people have searched for words like bite guard or teeth grinding over the last 2 months.
So they want to go for a cheaper option. They don't want to spend the $600.
People can also buy generic bite guards at a drugstore for around $20. But dentist David Samuels says patients sleep sounder and get far better protection from form-fitted ones. Still, here's something the dentist and the low-cost retailer Bancroft both agree on. No matter what you pay for your bite guard, don't leave it lying around.
Believe it or not, the animals, the dog and the cat, take them off the nightstand, chewed up.
Put it in a drawer when you're not using it. A little money-saving tip for people who grind their teeth as the recession grinds along. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nikisch for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
And it's the time in the show when we get to your questions about all kinds of financial matters. And here to help me this week with that is Kim Lankford. She writes the Ask Kim column for Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Do you have a least favorite question that people ask you about money?
I love all kinds of questions. I get questions from everyone. I even get questions from jail. And we earnestly answer all the questions we get. Yeah, it's just fascinating to see where all the questions can come from.
Well, that would be a first. I don't think we've ever had any questions from jail. So if you're listening, feel free to write. But first up, we have Marie in Minneapolis, who I believe is not in jail. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
You're not behind bars, right?
Not yet, no.
Okay, well, let's hope that never happens. How can we help you out today?
Well, I'm very fortunate in that I have an employer who contributes over 12% of my salary towards my retirement plan.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is generous.
And so my husband and I disagree on what my contribution should be. He thinks that I should still max out my portion because of the tax benefit and the fact that retirement will probably cost more than we think. And I wonder if it might be better to diversify my retirement savings and invest in something like a Roth or maybe something else post-tax that we could access into our 60s without penalty.
Boy, first of all, Kim, have you ever heard of a 12% contribution from an employer?
I think you work for the best employer in the world. I mean, that is wonderful. I mean, that is like, that puts you in such a wonderful start no matter what else you do. But you're also right that it is important to make sure that all your other bases are covered. And aside from retirement planning, also make sure you have enough money in an emergency fund. 3 to 6 months worth of essential expenses in that money market account or online savings account that you can access if you lose your job or have any surprise expenses. Just a few months ago, I profiled a family that was doing everything right, and they were setting aside all that money in retirement savings, and then the husband lost his job, and they didn't have that emergency fund, so they ended up having to rack up some credit card debt and tap that retirement fund and have to pay some penalties.
Assuming that she's got an emergency fund, do you, Marie?
We do.
Okay. And credit card debt?
Nope.
Okay.
Excellent.
So she's all set to put this money in retirement. Because she's already got the 12% going from the employer, should she be looking, say, at a Roth?
I really like your idea, Marie, of diversifying. And you can invest up to $5,000 in a Roth for 2009 or $6,000 if you're 50 or older. You don't get a tax break now, but you can access it tax-free in retirement. You can also use your contributions tax and penalty free at any time. And you don't have to take required minimum distributions at 70 and a half.
Okay.
So, Marie, what do you think? What do you think you'll want to do?
I think I'm going to go with my plan and diversify and invest some money into a Roth.
All right. Good luck, Marie, and thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That is 877-ASK-MONEY. In the meantime, we are going to Wheaton, Illinois, and Jonathan is on the line. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello.
What's your question for us today?
My wife and I are grad students in Illinois, and we own a rental property in North Carolina. But we'd like to sell it and use the proceeds from the house to pay off our student loans. Is there a way to do that without paying capital gains tax on selling the house?
Well, as long as you lived in it for 2 out of the past 5 years, you can generally exclude up to $500,000 of the gain from taxes.
And Jonathan, is that the case?
No, it's not. We haven't lived in there 2 of the last 5, so.
That's the tough thing. Then you will be subject to capital gains taxes. But did you do any home improvements on that property throughout the years?
We have Not done so much, probably less than $5,000 worth.
Well, try to dig up all those receipts you possibly can, because any home improvements you've done on the rental property through the years, you can add that to your tax basis. And your basis is usually what you paid for the property plus any significant improvements that have added to the value of the house. So that's things like, you know, adding a fence or air conditioning, improving the bathroom, things like that that's not regular maintenance. And just track down those receipts, because that can lower your tax bill a bit.
Jonathan, do you have a home that you live in as well that you own?
No, we actually live on campus at the school we're at now.
Ah, okay. So did you buy this property purely as an income property?
No, we bought it to, actually my wife bought it to live in it before we got married, and we got married pretty quickly, and then we moved out of North Carolina.
Ah.
All right, well, thank you so much, ma'am.
Thanks for calling, Jonathan.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. The Getting Personal link is at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more questions for Kim Lankford of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine in a bit. Break out the bubbly. The Dow crossed the 10,000 mark this week. Okay, so we're still quite far from the high watermark of more than 14,000 2 years ago. And there is talk that the Dow itself is a little bubbly right now and ready to pop. But still, the major stock indices have gained more than 50% since the market bottomed out in March. Even longtime market watchers must be scratching their heads over such massive price swings. And for those who aren't longtime, say those just starting out in their investing lives? Well, what on earth are they supposed to make of all this? Here with some answers is Stuart Ritter. He's a financial planner with T. Rowe Price. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
As you know, we're focusing on issues of kids and money over the next few weeks. I want to talk to you a little bit about what we might call older kids, perhaps folks in their early and mid-20s, who have been looking at what's happened in the stock market over the last year or so and wonder why anyone would ever bother. What's your advice to them?
They need to look beyond just what's happened in the last year or two. If you're in your early mid-20s, you have decades before you're going to be using money that you are setting aside for retirement. And that's hard for that age group sometimes to think about because everything has happened to them in 3-6 month increments. At the same time, just as you don't listen to the same music as your parents do, you probably don't want to invest the same way they've been investing.
I like that advice a lot. So then let's talk about some of maybe the rules that we can still follow or perhaps not follow. And this is a question I've been asking a lot of folks over the last few months. What still stands?
Well, I think, and forgive the corniness of the phrase, the new is mm-hmm. the tried and true. The fundamentals still apply. And what we've learned from what's happened is if you're sticking to the kinds of things that we know work in the long term, that is probably going to work out for you in the long term. So for younger people, what they need to focus on, first of all, is saving. I mean, before we can even talk about how they should invest the money, they've right. got to have some to invest. So managing your cash flow, making sure your expenses are lower than your income, as hard as it is when you're starting out, getting that piece right. Then when you do have money, recognizing that when you're saving for retirement, the money you're using is going to buy things that 50 years from now are going to cost a whole lot more. So while the stock market has felt uncomfortable in the last year, we're not talking about you're using the money in the next year or the next 2 years or the 10 years. It's many years after that. And that's where being in diversified equities, investing that way, makes sense for people who have that long of a time horizon.
I will make an admission now that when I was in my 20s, I was actually forced to set aside some retirement in my first job. And then when I moved to another city to take my second job, I promptly cashed it out. And boy, I look back now and wonder how many thousands, tens of thousands of dollars I missed out on because I did that. Can you take us through some of the math involved here, the basic math, why it's important to start that so early?
So when I talk to young folks and ask them, do you think you're going to get the full Social Security benefit currently promised you under the current rules, there's laughter in the room, to be
well,
frank.
Well, I'm 40 and I would laugh as well. So.
There you go. people realize, well, wait a second. If some of the current parts of income in retirement are going away, the only thing that's left is the money I save. The earlier you start, the less you have to save in terms of a percentage of your income. What happens is you are putting money into your account. And then when growth starts happening in your account, it's happening both on the money you put in and then on the growth that you've already gotten. And what tends to happen is if you look at what people's balances look like in retirement, if they've had these decades to save, the amount they've put in is actually a very small percentage of the ultimate balance because it's been in there so long that money has been made on money.
But again, we're talking about earnings on growth. And over the last year or so, we have not had growth. That's not true. We have had growth since the market bottomed out in March.
Well, I think you just answered your own question.
Okay, there you go. So my question was?
Your question was, if we haven't had it over the last year, can I count on it in the future?
Exactly.
And what we try to do is help people look beyond just that 1 year. For the 30-year period ending at the end of 2008, your average annual return was 11%.
Wow.
1 year right now looks really big, and it's been very difficult for people to live through. You compare that to 40, 70 years, it's going to be a very small piece of it. And that's the perspective we encourage young people to have.
All right. Stuart Ritter is an assistant vice president at T. Rowe Price Investment Services. He's also a financial planner with T. Rowe Price. And always good to have you come in. And thanks for talking to us about kids and money.
Thanks for having me.
Actor Donald Faison landed his first Hollywood role in the movie Clueless as a young man, and that led to more high-paying gigs, but it didn't lead to smart choices.
I wound up buying a house that I spent all my money on the down payment alone, so I bought a house that I really couldn't afford.
Hear what he's learned since then and what he's passing on to his kids. And if you want financial wisdom to pass along, be sure to never miss an episode of Marketplace Money. Download our podcast, and you can take the show with you wherever you go. You can subscribe at marketplace.org. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Here with me to take more of your questions is Kim Lankford of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. And Megan is with us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
So what's your question for us today? How can we help out?
Well, my boyfriend and I have been dating for about 3 years, and we've lived together for a little over a year. And in the past, we've dealt with shared expenses by saving all of our receipts and then doing some really complicated math in Excel.
And Excel is so romantic, isn't it?
It's so romantic, exactly. We end up being like, wait, did you pay for that with cash? It's really complicated. So we wanted to find a better way to do it, and we talked about either getting a credit card that we use only for shared expenses, or getting a bank account where we put in a set amount of money at the beginning and draw down from it only for shared expenses.
Mm-hmm. And you would both be co-owners of that account?
Right.
Well, any recommendation here outside of the Excel spreadsheet, which I agree would not be the most convenient way to tackle this?
Well, you all, first of all, you're so smart to deal with this. I tend to like the idea of having a shared banking account because that way you guys can both really keep track of how much you put in. You can keep track ahead of time of how much is in there so you avoid any big surprises at the end of the month.
So, Megan, what does your boyfriend say? What does he want to do?
Well, we've sort of gone back and forth on both of these. I mean, I like the idea of doing a bank account because I think it seems simpler, but there is a big upfront cost there, where you kind of have to have enough cash to put aside all of your expenses for the upcoming month in one account.
But Kim, couldn't they set it up basically so that they have, for example, automatic deposits into the shared account?
Oh, that's a good way to do it.
That's a great idea. And then you can figure out and kind of adjust it through time, depending on what your expenses are. But you know that a certain amount is going to be going into the account every month, you know, based on when you get paid. And that can help you adjust a lot of your expenses throughout the month, too. So I think that's a great idea. You know, the credit card thing, I definitely see what you're talking about with the big expenses. But you just really need to be aware of the risks. I mean, it could end up hurting both people's credit records. So it's just a risk you really need to keep in mind. But as you start to do this and get more accustomed to working together with all of this, that may be something you want to work up to for some special larger expenses, as long as you know those risks.
Great.
Well, bravo for even broaching the subject, because I think so many couples simply don't.
Thanks.
Big thumbs up.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Megan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And next we have Jen, who is also in the Washington, D.C. area. Hi, Jen.
Hello.
And is your question of romance and money as well today?
Yes.
It
yes.
is.
Some romance involved there.
Okay.
Well, I have one child, and my husband and I would like to have a second child. What's not so romantic is in my current job, I do not receive any maternity leave. So my question is, if taking out a disability insurance policy would provide some lost income during the birth of the child or for maternity leave?
Ooh, interesting question. Kim, does pregnancy count as disability?
It can, and it depends on the type of disability policy. Some states have rules about how much they'll cover and also have some rules about short-term disability policies available there. So it's important to contact your state insurance department. But to let you know about buying your own policy, generally, if you do buy a policy on your own, a lot of times that's a long-term disability policy. And many times there'll be usually a long waiting period, about 90 or 180 days or so before the coverage kicks in. And also you need to really look at the definition of disability carefully, because that can vary enormously. Some of them will only cover complications from pregnancy and maternity, not just maternity in itself.
So, Jen, how much of a determining factor is this?
I mean, I think we'll go for baby two one way or the other, but we're curious about other options.
And it's really important to look into all of that before you get pregnant, because once you get pregnant, if you're buying the policy on your own, that's a pre-existing condition, and that can make it really difficult to get coverage.
Pregnancy as a pre-existing condition, really? Oh, my goodness. So, Jen, I'll be very curious to see what you find in terms of both what your state requires and, you know, any private disability insurance that you might find. Will you update us and let us know what happens?
I will.
Thanks so much for calling.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Our number is 877-275-6669. That is 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Don't ask us why, Kim. Write to us online. Just find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kim Lankford of Kiplinger's Magazine, it's been great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for coming in and taking our calls.
Well, it is my pleasure. Thank you.
Now it's time to let some of you do the talking. We got a pile of responses to our segment on a couple who found themselves under a pile of debt. Candy and Russell Hildebrandt climbed out of a $100,000 hole in just 4.5 years. We billed it as a story of redemption. Richard Harrell of Washington, D.C. had a slightly different reaction. He writes, "That item about the Hildebrandts as heroes is insulting. Getting into debt was their own fault. I decided to get a PhD and ended up in the green. I knew how to live cheap and work hard. The Hildebrandts clearly could not." A few of you also took Candy to task for staying home to care for her three children instead of working in her spare time, I guess. But Christine Kwan of Milford, Michigan, found inspiration in the tale.
In order to truly know what you are made of, sometimes you have to fail wholly and completely. This couple persevered, persisted, and overcame, and in the end acquired wisdom, self-worth, and a stronger marital bond. They didn't ask for a bailout. They didn't ask for their family to fix the problem. They dug deep, became resourceful, worked together, and got the job done. I applaud the Hildebrandts.
Credit cards were the downfall of the Hildebrandts, and it wasn't just the interest rates and fees. It was the little plastic rectangle itself. That's according to Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Zweig. We talked with him recently about our brains on money. He said studies show the ease of using a credit card actually causes us to spend more. Have to write a check? Well, that's a lot more time to consider the funds you're forking over. Karina DeLugos of Glendale, Arizona, says checks help keep her family on a recession budget.
Now that our finances are tighter, we have paid much more in overdraft fees this year with unexpected auto drafts coming through and forgotten pre-scheduled payments. We have canceled most of them and now write checks for nearly every bill so we can keep better track of things. We take out cash for leisure, groceries, and gas and put them in envelopes every week. Once the money is gone, it's gone.
Freelance workers of the world take note of that advice. Tori Johnson of Women for Hire joined us a couple of weeks ago with some advice to free agents, this time on how to get paid for their work. But Megan Heyer of New Haven, Connecticut, thought Johnson missed the most important point.
No freelancer should ever work without a contract or letter of agreement that includes a description of the work, the schedule, and the payment arrangements. If I had to give my fellow freelancers one piece of advice for all time, this would be it. Never, 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 never work without a contract. Never.
And although we wish we never, never, ever made mistakes, sometimes one slips by us. In a recent discussion about zombie stocks, we said a stock symbol ending in Q meant the company was going through bankruptcy. While that is true, there is a decidedly healthy company that also sports a Q at the end of its symbol. That's tech giant Hewlett-Packard, which merged with Compaq a few years ago to form HPQ. Zombie they are not. Keep your comments coming. Marketplace.org is the way to do it.
Marketplace Money is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more, online at SaveAndInvest.org. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. When it comes to money, kids are, more often than not, utterly clueless.
Did I show you the loped-out Jeep Daddy got me? It's got four-wheel drive, dual side airbags, and a monster sound system. I don't have a license yet, but I need something to learn on.
Well, not all kids are that clueless, but money isn't a topic they learn much about in school or at home. Why? It's a question we're addressing over the next few weeks. Kids, money, how we teach it, what they think of it, all leading up to a special live show in Portland, Oregon next month. Donald Faison's first big acting gig was in Clueless before going on to star in the hit TV series Scrubs. And Clueless describes his own money management early in his career. He recently hosted a PBS special to get the word out on financial education. We sat down to talk with him about it.
Until Scrubs, I didn't have a business manager, and I learned everything on my own, and I learned the hard way. And also, nobody ever taught me how to manage my finances, and I don't think there's a class in high school now that you can sit in and learn how to make it so your money works for you. And so because of that, I wanted to get involved. That, and I get off on being in front of a camera.
I'm sorry, we can't provide that.
It's all good.
For
I get off and be in front of Mike too. Okay. In front of a mic too. So don't worry about it.
Tell us a little bit about some of the mistakes that you made.
You know, I did a movie called Clueless when I was first starting out, and with that paycheck, I went and bought a car, which I had no use for because I lived in New York City, where you can take a train for a dollar anywhere. But instead, I bought a $20,000 car with $12,000 check. You know what I mean? And so by the time the third payment came around, I didn't have the money to pay for the car. And I had to borrow money from my parents and from a bunch of people. That's one of the bigger mistakes that I made. That, and then I bought a house. Clueless, the television series, ended, and I was having kids at the time, and I thought, you know, the best thing for me to do right now is to buy a house to put my kids in a house, which is an admirable thing to do.
Sure.
But I wound up buying a house that I spent all my money on the down payment alone. So I bought a house that I really couldn't afford. And here comes month three, the mortgage is due, and I didn't have enough money for that. If I would have saved that money from the car and from, you know, the house, I probably would have been better off later on in life. I would have been more prepared for other financial problems that came my way, and I wasn't.
So how did you get yourself out of that pattern?
I hired a business manager.
Ah.
And now I have somebody who yells at me anytime I make an outlandish purchase.
I think we all could use that.
Yeah, well, it's great.
Someone yelling at us.
Yeah, it's great because, you know, just to hear, if you spend your money on this, you're going to go broke, scares you enough. So you automatically, well, I don't need to buy that then. And I don't need to buy that. You know, and I'm sure there's times where my business manager exaggerates, like, look, dude, you spend money on this and I promise you, you're going to regret it. When really, it'll be all right. But, you know, I still have to listen at the end of the day. He manages my money completely, to be honest with you, which is in a lot of ways, you know, not a good thing because you're supposed to know where your money's going and what you're doing with your money. But I'm so bad at it. Like, I have issues.
What do you mean?
Like, I just can't, I can't keep it in my pocket. I get it and it's gone.
You talked earlier about how you didn't really have a lot of money education growing up. And I think that's the case for most kids in this country.
Well, yeah, they never tell you how to save your money. No one tells you. We've been trained to spend money since we were born with all of these commercials with toys and G.I. Joes and Transformers. But there's so many things in the supermarket. There's so many things on television that automatically, when you turn it on, are saying, buy, 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 buy. And no one's ever saying, save, 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 save. It's trickery. They're trying to trick us into spending our money. And really, the best way out of it is to save your money.
How did you broach it with your children? Did you just say, okay, I said, we're going to sit down and talk about money?
Yeah, you guys are going to start saving your money. I'm trying to make sure that when my kids are, you know, 18, 16, you know, when they start making money and stuff, that they know what to do with their money. I started giving them allowance, and they all have bank accounts now. So
when did you start talking to them about money?
Recently, actually, once they started getting allowance, which was about a year ago. At first, you know, they'd get their allowance and go and buy the new Pokemon card or the new, you know, stuff that they didn't need. That started to change when I started saying, you know, I'm not going to buy you this video game. If you want the video game, you're going to have to buy it yourself. And from that, a bank account was created. And now, you know, these guys are proud to say, which is funny to hear, I have $60 in my bank account. Good for you. That's a lot of money for a preteen.
Why do you think we don't talk to our kids?
Because we're so caught up in our own situation that, you know, we don't talk about it. And for a long time, I don't think it's been a child's conversation to have. But nowadays, I think it's very important that children are involved in financial conversations. Now's the time to teach your 5-year-old kid about financing, to be honest with you. If they can add, I suggest you start teaching them about saving their money, you know, and what and how their money can add up in the future. I think the more you prepare your children for the future, the better off they'll be, you know, because my kids for some reason think I'm rich. And it's like, no, daddy's not rich. Daddy saves his money. And this is how he saved his money. And this is what you're going to learn how to do.
Actor Donald Faison talking with us about kids and money. We've been asking you, our listeners, for your stories about childhood and money, what your parents taught you or didn't, what you're teaching your kids or not. This week, a mom and her son recall the rough start to their allowance system.
My name is Elizabeth Lord.
I'm Xander Lord. I'm 8.
Adults get paid for the work they do for the most part. I felt that Xander should earn any money that he wanted towards things he liked. Getting the mail or the newspaper that's weighted at 50 cents. His least favorite job in the world is sweeping the back porch, which is $2. And he loves to do yard work, and that's about $3 because it's a lot of work.
Sometimes I save it. Sometimes I get stuff with it.
He loves Lego sets. He was looking at a $50 Lego set.
Well, it was a limited edition set. It was Space Police. I thought it was awesome. I started out with $25. Then I worked up to it.
Early on in the summer when we instituted this allowance, it was still a relatively new concept for Xander. So we started off with buying him the item that he wanted. Then he would work for it. He wouldn't be paid. He'd have to pay it back. We allowed that to happen for, I would say, a month and a half until he sort of slacked off on his chores and we weren't getting paid back. So we notified him, like a credit company would, that he was delinquent.
I was sad.
And he was sad. And I said, well, you're a bad credit risk right now, so you're going to have to earn your money before you can buy anything.
I don't know what Mom means by credit.
It's when you buy something first and then have to pay it back.
Oh, yeah.
So he's been very good, so we may institute some credit again.
Elizabeth and Xander Lord in Durham, North Carolina. We want your stories and your questions about kids and money. Find the link to submit them at marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, when parents are out of work, sometimes the strain shows.
There are good days and there are bad days, and I think the kids see that on our faces some days.
Marketplace Money is produced this week by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.